Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1798. The Earth had not even a billion humans, and Thomas Malthus warned we just couldn't go on multiplying. Next week, the UN says we'll hit 7 billion. And the debate rages on. Is there a limit, a carrying capacity? Have we passed it? Will we manage this hour on point, the Earth and 7 billion humans? Two big thinkers with us today on Earth and its load of humans. Joining me from Washington is Joseph Rome, physicist and climate expert who served in the Department of Energy in the Clinton administration. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and editor of the blog climateprogress.org. The journal Nature just published his big article, The Next Dust Bowl. Joseph Rome, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Oxford, England, is Mark Linus, author, journalist, longtime environmental activist, who's lately warmed to nuclear power and genetically altered food crops. He's a visiting research scholar at Oxford University's School of Geography and the Environment. In 2009, he was appointed climate advisor to the president of the Republic of the Maldives, or Maldives. His new book just out is called The God Species, How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans. Mark Linus, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Joseph, first to you. It wasn't that long ago that we were hearing we were going to level off the middle of this century. Now we're hitting 7 billion, and 3 billion more are expected to be added by the end of this century, I guess, 8, 9, 10 billion. So what's it mean? Can we do this forever? Is it going to settle back down? Where are we in this number surge? And can it just go right on, Joe?
Well, I think that, as you say, people thought we were going to level off faster. I think the problem is that, indeed, we are pushing against the ability of the planet to feed the 7 billion that we have. Food prices have been soaring. We've had the second major price spike in 3 years, and now food prices are as high globally as they have been since the late 1970s. And so we're seeing a confluence of factors. We have the rapid population growth. We also have more and more people entering the middle class, mm-hmm. where they switch to meat-based diets, and that consumes a lot more grain. It takes a lot more acreage of land to feed people with meat than it does with a vegetarian diet. We have this crazy biofuels policy where the U.S. is burning almost 40% of its corn crop in its engines, even though food prices are at record level and malnutrition appears to be on the rise in Africa. And then we have climate change, and climate change is causing extreme weather around the globe. The most recent example of extreme weather affecting food is what's the devastating floods that people are probably hearing about in Thailand, which mm-hmm. probably devastated, you know, maybe 15% of their rice crop, and they are the world's biggest rice exporters. Last year, it was, of course, Russia that banned grain exports after the devastating heat wave. Texas has been devastated by its own drought and heat and kind of returning to Dust Bowl era levels of devastation. And this is just the beginning of if we don't take action to reduce heat-trapping gases, we're going to see more extreme weather and more drought and Dust Bowlification. So I do think, you know, and I wrote in Nature just published yesterday that the greatest challenge the human race is going to face is how to feed 9 billion people by mid-century. I can tell you one thing. If we keep doing what we're doing, it is just going to be virtually impossible. So
I want to take this to Mark, Joe, but one more question just to get you on the record before I do. Malthus, 1798, says, can't go on, won't go on, people will die. Club of Rome, 1972, something similar, the limits of growth. What do you think? 7 billion, 8 billion, 9 billion, 10 billion? Are people going to die, or are we going to see dramatic change, or somehow we just go rocking on?
Well, I will tell you, there are certainly a number of climate scientists and others who think a lot of people will die. I'm a little bit more optimistic. I don't think the world is going to let hundreds of millions of people starve to death or suffer in this manner. I just think we are going to reorganize the way we do business. I think we're going to reorganize the way we do energy. the way we do food. The U.S. loses, you know, wastes about a third of the food that we get, and that's true of much of the rich countries. And again, the biofuels policy, that will have to change. It's just if large numbers of people are starving to death, the United States is not going to keep burning large fractions of the world's grain crop in its engines, and neither will the Europeans.
Joe Rome, stand by right there if you would. I want to go to Mark Linus in Oxford. And Mark, first, just to look at the number that the UN says is coming upon us. You know, they're saying it's October 31st. Who knows? But it's right around now, apparently. We will tick past 7 billion. How do you see it? Is it a big deal? You know, are we already at some carrying capacity and or past it and don't even know? Or are we endlessly ingenious and we figure it out? How do you look at it, Mark?
I'm pretty much in the optimistic camp. And if you look forward to the UN's projection, which now seems to have been raised past 10 billion or 11 or 12 or who knows what by the end of this century. Yeah, I mean, this has come about because of a small tweak in one of their projections, one of their models. So I don't think we should set too much store about what happens in the next, you know, 70 or 80 years. But we're certainly going to be seeing a population of 9 billion by 2050. That's a sort of mid-range estimate. And as Joe says, the greatest challenge is to feed these people and to feed them well and on increasing incomes, where they will be demanding more Western, more meat-based type diets. And to do that in the context of a land-constrained, water-constrained world, which is also being affected by climate change.
Feed them and feed them well. That applies no limits in some way. I mean, are we all going to sit around eating like kings? We've certainly, diets in the developed world have become richer and richer over time, more and more meat protein-based. Do you think that lifestyle goes on, or Joseph Rome suggests we may be seeing big changes of all kinds, perhaps including what we eat and how much we eat?
Well, I think we need, first off, to have a fairly strong dose of humility when we make these very long-term projections, particularly because we don't know what technologies are going to be doing. I mean, the last big outbreak of Malthusianism before the limits to growth stuff in the 1960s and 70s was at the turn of the 20th century, when the fertilizers which were being mined from the Chilean deserts and the guano off the coasts of South America were running out. And people were saying that we won't be able to feed the population that we have now, which at that point was probably a billion or so, because we're running out of fertilizer. Lo and behold, in a laboratory, the problem was solved through the Haber-Bosch process, which figured out how to make ammonia out of atmospheric nitrogen. So nobody anticipated that there would be this enormous technological breakthrough. Same as in the 60s and 70s, the population doomsayers didn't anticipate the Green Revolution, which has enabled such massive growth in productivity in India and China and other developing countries that these countries became almost food exporters, certainly able to feed themselves. And these massive famines that were predicted back then never came to pass. And so I certainly would not feel comfortable predicting massive famines going forward either. I think there's a lot we can do, and I think scientists and crop biotechnologists understand there's a huge amount we can do to improve yields in the low-yielding parts of the world at the moment.
Well, look at how that might work. Joe Rome, there was Malthus saying this can't go on, and then boom, we get a huge increase in use of fossil fuels by humans, and that brings all kinds of productivity that makes a very much larger human population possible. Do you see a technology bailout again that takes the lid off a kind of limit of any kind on human population here? I mean, here's Mark talking maybe 11, 12 billion.
Well, I worked at the Department of Energy for 5 years in the 1990s, running the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy for part of that. I understand and firmly believe that we have the technologies to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions if we choose to use them aggressively now. So that is a choice. Right now, we're choosing not to take any action. So I'm optimistic that we could solve address a large number of these problems through technology. But politically, we're not making those choices.
What do you mean? We could, okay, 7 billion is a lot. It's a lot more than just 50 years ago. It's 4 billion more than double. So are you saying, okay, yes, we could pull out 8, we could pull out 9, 10, 11, 12 billion even. We can do it.
Well, I think
technologically, even leave the politics out.
No,
that's a big piece.
I don't
want to
think
ignore
tech.
It.
No, I think if you study this hard, and I do a lot of posts on this at Climate Progress, technology will take you so far. I think technology could, for instance, really slow greenhouse gas warming. And keep it maybe to 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit rather than another 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which would just render large parts of the planet, you know, uninhabitable, or at least, you know, it would stop food production in large places right now. So I think we have a choice. The path we're on, we cannot possibly sustain, you know, 10 or 11 billion people, because we are going to, as I said, in nature, you know, as much as a third of the currently habited and arable land will turn to the equivalent of Dust Bowl, the levels of soil moisture that we saw during the 1930s Dust Bowl. But instead of lasting 7 years, it's going to just last decade after decade after decade.
Mark Linus, in Oxford, if I may, we just got half a minute before the break, but is it possible that we are in a breakdown phase already? The polar ice cap melting in the north, and you see all the other evidence of what's happening. Is it possible that we're already in a kind of population-generated breakdown here?
I don't think it's so plausible. And in any case, where does that analysis lead you? I mean, if you look back in back in the 1960s and 70s, as I say, when the population Malthusians were really winning the argument, it seemed at the time, the logical policy outcome of that was that you shouldn't feed populations which you thought were already too big. And in a situation where we've got a situation of famine or near famine in parts of Somalia and northeast Africa, I don't think we can say we shouldn't feed these people because there's just too many of them. I mean, that's practically heading towards genocide.
Mark Linus' new book is The God Species. We're looking at the human population headed to 7 billion. Next week, we're told, this is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mark, Joe, we've got a lot of callers here. Bo in Charleston, South Carolina. Bo, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Yeah, I would just like to say it needs to be noted that this increase in population has almost been directly affected by our extraction of natural resources, of oil. Specifically, you were saying earlier, by 1800, we only had about 1 billion people on the planet. 1800 and nearabouts there is when oil, we started to really harness the power of oil and therefore industrial agriculture, which greatly increased our output of being able to feed ourselves and feed other people.
So what about now? Can we keep doing that?
I absolutely think not. I think the illusion of cheap oil and cheap food can only go so far. Because if you study other populations of species in nature, when they start to get very comfortable with their food supply, they start eating a lot, they start procreating, there's a huge spike in their population. They deplete the resources around them, and inevitably there is a decline.
Look around. Look at all the populations not human, and that's what we see. Of course, we are this interesting species. We'll look at it. Bo, I appreciate your call. Lots of comments online here. Marcus says, I feel like we're playing whack-a-mole with the planet's problems while the number of moles keeps increasing. Yosh says, the problem is that human biomass is replacing the biomass of everything else on the planet. Recipe for failure. The herd needs thinning. Sounds like drastic. I don't know what that means exactly. Danielle in Woodward, Iowa. Danielle, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I teach environmental science and also ecological restoration, and I had this population discussion with my students yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have their rose-colored glasses on any longer. I'm a realist. I'm not scared to death. This will play out in very devastating ways for many people around the world. We have to get a handle on human population. David Pimental, professor emeritus from Cornell University, believes that the carrying capacity of this planet, with people living a moderate European style lifestyle, is 2.5 billion.
We're well past that already. So what are you telling your students to anticipate?
That I am not in favor of war, famine, or disease to limit human population. It's going to be up to them that they could be the greatest generation that this planet has ever seen. They will have the greatest challenges. They will live longer in this uncertain future than I will. And what I did yesterday was pass out boxes of condoms to my students. The Center for Biological Diversity is initiating a discussion about human population, and they have these very clever little boxes of condoms, 2 condoms per box.
What's your message there to your students, Danielle? Do not reproduce.
You have to choose. You are the first generation that has to ask yourself, whether or not you will have a child, and if you do, how many. And to that, for that, I apologize to them.
Well, of course, the first generation, maybe in this country, not certainly around the world, China has, you know, demanded lots of particularity on that front. But Joe Rome, what about it, just in terms of reproduction? I thought Danielle was saying she just passed out, but she's passing out condoms. Is a slowdown in the birth rate in the cards? It doesn't look like it from the UN projections.
You know, I think it's very hard to say. In my blog, I have focused more on consumption because, you know, it is the way we use energy and resources that matters considerably more. I mean, the 7% of the wealthiest in the world use half the resources, and half the population use about 7% of the resources. So, you know, it's like the Occupy Wall Street and the, you know, I am the 99% movement. We have this grotesque disparity, and it is the richest who are causing this problem, and it is incumbent upon us to spend some money to address it. And it is not, if we were to act now to aggressively push clean energy, solar, wind into the marketplace, into start redesigning our agricultural system, I do think that this is all manageable. But, you know, it is true. We avoided Malthus because in large part because of fossil fuels, but we created climate change, which Mark knows as well as anybody. We're on a path towards, you know, 6 degrees centigrade or 10 degrees Fahrenheit warming this century, which is not practical for feeding the amount of people that we're gonna have. So, you know, we have a choice. Humanity has a very clear choice. If we were to act now intelligently and aggressively, I think we can manage this. If we keep business as usual, though, I think in the lifetime of most of your listeners, they're going to see changes that I think will surprise and shock them.
What Danielle says from Iowa, wake up, no more happy talk. I mean, it is so interesting how this subject really flirts around the panic button. On the one hand, yes, maybe we can do it. On the other hand, good heavens, where are we headed here? Alan in Falmouth, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I had a question about the potential psychological and behavioral implications of so many people being on the planet, both with resources being available or with a stretch of resources. I wonder if you could.
What kind of kind of psychological question, Alan? Like what?
Well, like, will it increase conflict amongst people and potentially lead to more war and destruction and difficulty with people getting along and finding political solutions to difficult problems?
Yeah. Mark Lyons, Linus, how about it? Do we get smart and creative or just, you know, grab for what's there and go to war? What about the psychology of a more crowded planet?
Well, it's interesting. You can see psychology playing out here in terms of how people respond to the challenge that you're giving them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people are very pessimistic. Some people get panicky about it, and some people think that we're more likely to find a way out, which may not be visible at the moment, but it'll happen. And you know, no one's mentioned at the moment this concept of the demographic transition, which simply states that birth rates tend to fall below replacement levels when populations reach a certain level of economic development and urbanization. And in fact, this is happening much more rapidly than was ever predicted. And you know, it's not true that birth rates are still high. They're down at about 2.5 now, children per woman, and its replacement level is 2.1, 2.2. So we're actually heading down in that direction, and that's because populations are getting wealthier. So this assumption I think people have that there's this collision course with the population rising and people getting richer, actually people getting richer tends to solve the population problem, but of course at the expense of more resources being consumed overall. And that's a question that we absolutely have to address.
You're right, of course, on the birth rate. Nevertheless, there's the absolute number still going up. That March 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, as you say, I mean, no matter what the birth rate, those are very imposing numbers. And we're hearing again and again from Joe Rahm, in some ways from you today, Mark, that we don't have forever here, that this sort of rest of this century is this, it's been often described as a kind of make or break period of time in which that population rises and rises. So what about, you know, does the planet just go to war?
I don't think so. I mean, without quibbling too much about the numbers, birth rate does matter enormously in terms of the population we'll see in the second half of the century. But in terms of 2050,
eventually,
we're heading for 9
billion. In this window, we're headed up, no matter what the rate.
Of course. No, that's what I'm saying. We're heading for 9 billion. There's not much you can do about it because people who are alive today will, by and large, still be alive then, or their children will be. So there isn't much you can do about that number. And we have to feed these people. And my proposal is that we look at this idea of planetary boundaries. That's what I talk about in the book, which does include things like land use, it does include things like water use, it does include artificial fertilizers, and it includes climate change. I'm proposing, on the basis of scientific work here, this isn't original to me, that the planetary boundary for CO2 in the atmosphere should be 350 parts per million. That was crossed back in 1988 when James Hansen first gave his presentation to the Senate, to the US Senate. So there isn't any carbon space left. You know, we're going to have to change things radically here. I'm not in any way saying we can continue with business as usual, but I do think we have the capacity to do that, and I do think that politically things are beginning to shift slowly but surely in the right direction.
You write, you say, unlike, say, the Limits to Growth report produced by the Club of Rome, the planetary boundaries concept does not necessarily imply any limit to human economic growth or productivity. Instead, it seeks to identify a safe space in the planetary system within which humans can operate and flourish indefinitely in whatever way they choose. And you write about doing that with being gentle on the earth as we do that. I want to ask how that works. You say it doesn't necessarily mean ditching capitalism, in your view, or the profit principle or the market, as many of today's campaigners demand, you write. You say it's no time for pessimism. We have some very powerful tools available to allow us to live more gently on this planet if only we choose to use them. So you see the population marching up, and you say that can be just fine. We can be the God species. What do you mean by God species, and what would you do with that near divine power?
Well, that's a lot to deal with. But, I mean, the divine power is a reality, whether you like it or not. That's why geologists are talking about us being in a new human-dominated geological era known as the Anthropocene, because it's up to us essentially what temperature the planet stabilizes at. It's up to us what the chemistry is of the atmosphere. It's up to us what the acidity is of the oceans. It's up to us how much of the land use is devoted to human sustenance and so on. And that gives us much more of a power than of all your volcanoes and earthquakes and everything else added together.
In other words, we have to become active sort of engineers of the whole planetary system.
Well, we are already active managers of the planetary system. The problem is most of that management is done by default and it's done badly. Every time we have meetings about solving the climate change problem, every single year the UNFCCC, Framework Convention on Climate Change, gets together and has these negotiations. That is an attempt at planetary management. You know, we had a successful effort at planetary management with regard to the ozone layer. This is probably the one big success story that we've got. There's also biodiversity. We haven't mentioned that yet, but we're in the sixth mass extinction. We need to stop depleting the wild species that share this planet with us, and that will also require a planetary-scale effort. So my simple proposal is that we need to learn to work together much better as a species at an international level.
Richard in Mount Arab, New York. Richard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, the human race is what ecologists call a single peak event. That means population grows geometrically in number, then crashes and burns. This whole idea that was mentioned just a few moments ago of a demographic transition is total phony baloney. There is no kind and gentle way that the human race or a population in the throes of approaching a single peak event is going to just even out, and we'll come to a nice and gentle equilibrium. My own studies, I've published back in 2006 in ecological modeling for population dynamics, show that when any species' ability to extract resource from this planet for maintaining their life processes exceeds a certain threshold, you get a single peak event. That means that most populations on the planet, whether you're a yeast or a white-tailed deer or whatever, you come up against the limits. Simply, you can't get enough sustenance to either be healthy or continue on. You have a bad winter, and life is harsh, and the population, because of this die-off, this inability to obtain resource at a great rate, comes to an equilibrium.
Richard, what about human ingenuity in that picture? Do you put stock in that notion that we can engineer our way out of this
only
or not?
Only up to a point, and we are pushing it. It simply means that when the crash comes, it's going to simply be a lot harder.
Richard, I appreciate your call. Joe Rahm, look at that. I mean, you've written the next Dust Bowl. Richard sounds more in that camp here. On a planetary scale, do you buy the idea of a demographic transition, or does it sound like phony baloney to you? Can we, you know, downshift here? Our caller says there's no kind and gentle way to do it. We're headed for a crash. What do you say, Joe?
Well, I think if we keep on our current path, there is likely to be a crash of some sort. I've mm-hmm. you know, called us the global Ponzi scheme because we are living off the wealth of future generations, taking their soils and their fisheries and their livable climate and their resources, and it's our own children. So I think, like any Ponzi scheme, it is unsustainable and it would crash. Now, I agree with Mark that we need, let's say, a target of, he said, 350 parts per million of atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, which is the principal heat-trapping gas. We're at over 390 and rising two a year. In order to get what Mark wants, we would have to replace the entire energy system of the rich countries with carbon-free sources in 20 years, and then we'd have to replace the entire energy system of the developing countries with carbon-free sources in the subsequent 20 years. I believe it can be done.
But we're on nothing like that path right now.
We're on nothing like that path right now. So we are completely divergent, and we are headed towards what Mark wrote, you know, in his previous book, 6 degrees centigrade, 10 degrees, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, our future on a hotter planet. That's what we're headed towards. So we could do it, but boy, would it require changes that we're not even talking about at a national level in the United States of America. And Mark knows as well as anybody, China was fighting even modest climate agreement in Copenhagen, and they're building coal plants at a rapacious level, and they now exceed our greenhouse gas emissions. So China and the U.S., almost 50% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and we are both refusing sensible action.
Mark Linus, we're talking in the U.S. You're sitting there in the U.K. You see the planetary situation. I mean, the God species may sound great, but, you know, what if we're not stepping up to put on those robes? What if we're just not going to, you know, do it, the sort of we can do it path that you outline here?
Yeah, well, I mean, the reasons for pessimism are many and legion and overwhelming. And some days I wake up and I think, yeah, you're right, we're not going to make this one. But, other, you know, that what is that? That isn't actually a very useful position to start from, because we've got to do our best at the very least. And, you know, there's some glimmers of hope on the horizon here. Actually, most developing countries, and I don't mean China, but I mean the least developed countries and the small island states, and obviously, as you mentioned at the beginning, I advise the Maldives, can go carbon neutral relatively quickly because they haven't yet put in this large energy infrastructure. So they can leapfrog the dirty stage of development and go straight for renewables.
Maldives is teeny tiny, minute.
It is teeny tiny, but if you add together all of the small island states, that's a gigaton of carbon. If you add together all of the off-grid places in Africa and other and India and so on, these are places which are currently mostly run from diesel generators, which is very expensive. And you actually look and you see solar photovoltaic panels are already at grid parity.
But there's China, there's the USA with their output. We'll come back and look at what your God species recipe for success would be, and we'll look the other way too. Mark Linus, please stand by in Oxford, England. Joseph Rome in Washington at climateprogress.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about the human population of the planet, headed next week, more or less, the UN says, past the 7 billion mark. Peter in Auburn, Alabama is calling. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The first two things that I think are really important to talk about are what actually leads to prosperous nations. And I think we have a lot of good models to look after Hong Kong, Singapore, Dubai, which are based on British common law, which actually allow for legal structures to have free markets to grow and to be prosperous. The second thing we need to be concerned about is sustainable grid power. Now, I'm a big advocate of nuclear, modular nuclear reactors, particularly the liquid fluoride thorium reactors, which would allow also as a byproduct to produce the amount of ammonia we need to sustain a 10 billion population with the amount of food that we need for the agricultural production. So when I look at the problem, I say, okay, we need to address this in a way that is quick, free market, in a sustainable manner. And I look at the nuclear as a very good thing because these nuclear reactors can be churned out one a day the same way Boeing churns out 76 have it.
Peter, we'll look at nuclear power. I promise you. Let me ask you a question, though. You're for free markets, and gosh, that would be awesome. They're exciting. They produce all kinds of great stuff. On the other hand, look at the two biggest kind of free markets in the world, the U.S., and at this point, a lot of free market going on in China. They're also the two biggest emitters of the kind of environmental pollution that's getting us in trouble. What does that tell you, Peter?
And absolutely, I agree with you. But I think a lot of the reason why is we have a lot of information and intervention from the government related to innovation in the energy sector. Look at the LFR, the lift to reactor that I mentioned before.
But the market, the representatives of the market beat the government's head in when they try and limit emissions.
Absolutely, I agree. And a lot of time that's information asymmetrics, and I agree that's a big problem. But one of the things we need to look at is how are these things hampered by government intervention? And like I said, with the nuclear stuff, I know you want to have point later, but the big thing about that is we developed the technology back in the 70s at Oak Ridge National Laboratories, non-proliferation, it's not under pressure. The same guy who made the light water reactor came up with a design that said, hey, this is going to solve our problems, it doesn't burn on uranium, non-proliferation problems, but it was pushed down because we were in the Cold War, we wanted to make bombs. So I'm saying the solution exists, and if you look towards the free market and you don't over-regulate things, possibilities can arise.
Peter, let us pick it up. Mark, let's go to nuclear. I mean, a lot of people looked at that, safety issues, waste issues, and all the rest, Three Mile Island and beyond, and said, whoa, wait a minute. And, I mean, our caller's right. The government, not to mention the market, both got skittish about that. Now, maybe those are interrelated. You are for bringing nuclear up in a big way to address what's right in front of us here population-wise. Why, Mark?
Well, the government does have a big role in developing these technologies first off, and as your caller said, we opted for the much less safe and secure light water reactors, mainly pressurized water reactors, as a byproduct of needing to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. Now, those days have gone now, and we can actually look to some much safer and more sustainable designs of nuclear fission, including the liquid fluoride reactor that your caller was talking about. There's also the Integral Fast reactor. I've looked into that. It seems like a really interesting idea because we can use that, as well as the fluoride one, to burn up existing waste stockpiles, all the long-lived things that mean we've got serious problems with how to dispose of nuclear waste over, you know, literally thousands of years. That can actually be burnt up and we can actually generate low carbon electricity. So to judge nuclear fission by the reactors, say like the one in Fukushima, which were designed in the 1960s, is a bit like judging the, you know, the new Boeing Dreamliner by the standards of the DC-10.
So I mean, you'd go wild with nuclear? You'd put tons and tons of lots and lots of new nuclear power out there to cut back on fossil fuels? Is that core to your recipe?
It's one aspect of it. I mean, nuclear isn't a silver bullet. I'd put probably more money into renewables, particularly offshore wind, and we need to keep trying to get the price of solar down. It's falling very rapidly at the moment, which explains some of the recent bankruptcies. But, you know, we have to do our best across the board here, and it means putting a large amount of money both into R&D for clean energy technologies and scaling up what we already know how to do.
What about on the agriculture front? NJ writes online here she doesn't share your faith in techno-salvation. She says the Green Revolution you praise is not sustainable. It's based on intensive use of fossil fuels, synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, economies of scale. And she writes, genetic engineering of food production is fraught with problems. What about it, Mark Linus?
Well, yes. I mean, there are certainly problems with the Green Revolution, and there are enormous sustainability challenges, as your correspondent mentions there. I do think biotechnology can be useful, though, because many of the insect-resistant GM crops mean that much less or no insecticide is used at all. So that actually reduces the amount of pesticides which is used on crops like cotton in places like India. And I think we're also looking now, hopefully, at more nitrogen-efficient, water-efficient crops. Joe mentioned at the beginning of this about the floods in Thailand. There are genetic engineering efforts at the moment going on to develop flood-resistant rice and other staple crops, which may well be useful in an era of more dramatic climate change. Again, I'm not saying that these are silver bullet technologies which will get us out of a fix, but I think to rule them out on rather spurious green orthodox grounds would be a big mistake.
And nevertheless, when you sort of add up the number, the vectors of challenge here or stress, you know, flood-resistant, drought-resistant, it seems like maybe there's a path, but doesn't it feel like quite a high wire, Mark Linus, for the whole human population to be out on? You know, if we hit all these marks just so we can make it through this pass, what are the odds of us pulling off this challenge?
I don't know, but I think they're as good as they were in the 60s and 70s when we looked at equally daunting challenges in the future. So I don't think it's that historically unprecedented what we're seeing at the moment in terms of the tools that we've got available, the money we've got available. I mean, just take Africa, for example. If you raised African productivity through their own green revolution up to about 80% of the world average, then Africa would be able to feed itself. That's certainly not the case at the moment. So raising productivity through actually increasing the amount of fertilizer and the access to capital that farmers have in Africa, that's something that Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is working on very hard. And I think, you know, there's so much positive stuff going on at the moment that I think to sort of look at this big number and be daunted and be pessimistic would really be the wrong conclusion.
Joe, I want to get you on that. First, Amber in Buffalo, New York. Amber, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm calling about water, and I'm wondering, with all of this talk about food requires water to for irrigation. Also, all these people, what are you going to do about sewage? What are you going to do about all of these other waste treatments that need to happen? And I'm calling because I'm out water quality sampling right now with people from Buffalo Niagara Riverkeeper, and we see this as being a huge issue. We live in the Great Lakes. We have this great resource of water, but is it enough? Is it polluted? What are they going to do about water, I think, is being a big issue with population growth.
Amber, I'm so glad for your call. Fresh water. Joe Rome, there's Amber on the shores of the Great Lakes looking forward at these population numbers and, you know, trying to figure out how do we get enough on the front end, the back end. You're writing about Dust Bowl. Talk to us about water, Joe.
Well, water is the great challenge because, you know, the global warming changes the water cycle. It makes dry areas drier and wet areas wetter, and this country and other countries have seen it. We are seeing more intense droughts and more intense floods. The southwest of the United States, as I write in Nature, according to, you know, many major scientific studies in the past few years, is headed towards a permanent dust bowl. And it will be, you know, nearly uninhabitable. It certainly won't be able to sustain the population. Hasn't. And the last time we had a dust bowl, hundreds of thousands of families moved.
What do you mean when you say southwest headed toward a dust bowl? Paint some points on the map for us that you think are going to be locked in that.
Yeah, it's you know, from the Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, all the way over to Southern California. We'll see, according to the models, levels of soil moisture comparable to that we saw during the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, except, unlike the Dust Bowl, it's going to be much hotter. And the thing is that as it gets hotter, first the soil dries out, but once the soil dries out, then the heating just goes straight into temperature, which is why Texas broke the all-time record in the United States for the hottest summer of any state by 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit from the previous record, which had been Dust Bowl, Oklahoma, 1934.
And so meanwhile, they're going they're using a lot of water to go after the fracked gas under Texas.
Well, they are using a staggering amount of water. And in fact, after agriculture, energy is the biggest consumer of water for cooling plants and as you say, for fracking and the like. So this path is also not sustainable. And the two best ways of getting extra fresh water, desalinization and reverse osmosis water purification, are also both very energy intensive. I can tell you one thing Americans will be seeing more and more of in the future, which is using sewage water to purify it straight back to tap water, toilet to tap, as they say. This is going to be one of the things that you're going to see. I think you're going to see a lot of other changes. But, you know, as I said, it is going to be a challenge. People think climate change is just going to affect poor countries a long time from now. It is affecting the United States now, and it's going to affect the United States increasingly if we don't get on the path that Mark talked about, which is a dramatic shift towards clean energy. The good news is the clean energy is there. Solar energy is coming down in price. Wind power has become a successful commercial venture. There's vast amounts of energy efficiency. There are many other technologies. But you have to have the political and government will to embrace them. And right now in this country, we have one political party which absolutely denies climate science and opposes aggressive development and deployment of clean energy.
Jim in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, he just kind of spoke to my point. He had mentioned, one of your guests had mentioned, that the one way out, a possible way out of this was for people, with our, you know, basic, ingenuity, intelligence, getting together and, you know, coming up with some kind of solution. But when you've got, you know, two entrenched camps, you know, one that does not believe in any kind of global warming or certainly a human cause for it, and then another group that seems to be the vast majority, you know, with backed up by science, you know, how can we bring those two camps together? You know, reasonable people, you know, coming together and talking.
Jim, I appreciate your call. Mark, I mean, you're watching this from the UK, but you know U.S. politics pretty well, I suppose. And then there's the rest of the world. I mean, where does the impetus come from to do this and do it promptly and do it on the kind of scale that you're describing?
Oh, I mean, the U.S. is in a class of its own in terms of the dysfunctionality and corruption of its domestic politics. And I can say that, with some knowledge of how other countries work. Mm. You know, I've worked for the Maldives and other developing countries. And I can also say it's nothing like that here in the U.K. There is a cross-party consensus that climate change is real, for a starting point, and also that we need to do something about it. There's disputes about how much it's going to cost and where we should put the money and green taxes and so on and so forth. But there's no party anywhere in Europe or anywhere else in the civilized world where they're saying that climate change doesn't exist. And, you know, it's depressing to see in the US how this has become almost an aspect of a culture war, a bit like abortion and evolution.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it is that kind of an issue. It's going to be that difficult to resolve. And that's one of the reasons I'm more enthusiastic about nuclear, because even the climate deniers and most Republicans think nuclear is a good idea. And, well, let's just do it in that case on a large scale and don't tell them it's being used to solve global warming.
Yeah, just do it to make money. Liz in Ithaca, New York. Liz, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, thanks. I feel like we are definitely already in our doomsday time, and it's only going to get worse. We've seen, as your guest said, some of the hottest temperatures. We've seen flooding that was never seen before across New England, the tsunami. Climate issues are devastating all the time now. It's things we've never seen before. And if we're thinking of only in the U.S., I have neighbors around me who can't get food, who can't grow their own food because now seeds are being terminator so that they can't reproduce on their own. So
you mean genetically modified seeds that you can't harvest off your own crop and plant again? Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then across, that's just in the first world country here in my, you know, my neighborhood. And then you think about third world, people are already in the doomsday. People are not able to eat. They don't have access to fresh water, to health problems. Diseases are getting worse. We're already in a crisis, and we're still not responding. Our government's not responding as it should be. And I think it's only going to get worse, unfortunately.
Liz, I appreciate your call. Joe Rahm, you talked about the map of the U.S., and you looked at the Southwest. Look at the whole planet. How do you see this population weight hitting first and hardest if we don't get on top of it? Where? How?
Well, it's going to hit first and hardest in Africa. It's in the poorest of the continents. It is very vulnerable to climate change. I interviewed Chris Funk, one of the leading experts on the cause of desertification, of drought in East Africa, and they had predicted, he was a scientist who predicted last year that we would see this devastating drought in East Africa because of the war, in part because of the warming of the Indian Ocean. And, you know, it is, as you get hotter and drier, the countries that have marginal agriculture have obviously a greater and greater challenge. And I'm all for the Gates Foundation and others developing drought-resistant and flood-resistant crops. But developing Dust Bowl-resistant crops, that I think may be a challenge too far. So I think the great, great challenge is going to start in Africa. But it is going to spread to other countries. And one should also remember sea level rise, which causes saltwater infiltration of some of the richest deltas in the world, the Nile Delta, the Ganges, Bangladesh. These are going to be great, great challenges. Egypt, why did Egypt have such a revolt? Mm. When food prices went up, it didn't affect the U.S. that much, but 40% of a family budget goes to food in Egypt. So when food prices go up 50%, it is a very big deal. So countries who live on the margin, where food is a very large fraction of the family budget, it becomes the big challenge. And by the way, I agree with Mark. It is totally, totally incumbent on the world to to help feed the people, because the people who are suffering the most from climate change and biofuels policies are not the people who caused climate change. It is the rich countries, and we have a moral obligation to do something about that.
Let's get our minds and action to work on this. Mark Linus writes that humans can operate and flourish indefinitely, but he says this will require limiting our disturbance to key Earth system processes. He says, but in my view, this need constrain neither humanity's potential nor its ambitions, but it only works if we get busy on it and make it workable and with a little more urgency, at least in this country, than it's been going so far. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us this hour. Mark Linus, author of The God Species, How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans, joining us from Oxford, England. Mark, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been great.
And Joseph Rome with the Center for American Progress, climateprogress.org. See his piece, The Next Dust Bowl, in the journal Nature. Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good luck to us all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.